John, for not throwing me under the bus, because I noticed in the printed order of worship that the wrong number was there for that last song in the order of worship, so I apologize for that. But we're glad that you're here, as we've already expressed. And again, John records the statement for the basis of our study this morning, as we've done for the last several weeks. I know that today is Father's Day, and as little Johnny one time said, somebody said, "Johnny, what's the difference in Father's Day and Mother's Day?" He said, "Well, there's no real difference in Father's Day and Mother's Day, except you just don't have to spend as much on the present for Father's Day as you do for Mother's Day." And, you know, typically on Mother's Day, we have the sentimental, sweet, mushy sermons about mothers and motherhood. And then on Father's Day, we give fathers a good beating up because they need to be better men and better examples and better Christians. And, you know, sometimes I felt like the kind of sermons that normally you preach on Father's Day, it'd be a good idea if that's a Father's Day sermon, that the opening day of duck season ought to be called Duck's Day. So anyway, be that as it may, we're going to continue the theme we've been studying for the last several weeks, where John records the words of Jesus. Where in John chapter 10 and verse 10, Jesus said, "I came that they might have life, and they might have it more abundantly." And we've talked about how that to live that abundant life Jesus wants us to live, we've got to rise above certain things. We've got to rise above fear and anger and conflict. We've got to rise above the things that exist in our past. Well, I want to ask you this morning if you remember as a child going to vacation Bible school. And you remember in vacation Bible school you would sing that song, "I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart." If we're going to live the abundant life that Jesus Christ wants us to live, we've got to have the joy in our hearts. Far too often, we sing that song as children, and we sing it smiling and with gusto and enthusiasm, and we grow up, and we become jaded, and we become cynical, and somewhere along the way, we lose the joy that Jesus Christ wants us to have. You see, when you get right down to it, and you look at this world you and I live in 2025, there are a lot of people in this world that have lost their joy. I remember reading the other day about a man and his wife who arrived at the emergency room of the hospital. Both of them were suffering from gunshot wounds. It seems the husband woke up late for his first day on a new job. His wife had failed to set the alarm clock. So he did what any man in his position would do. He took his pistol and shot her. Well, he shot her in the arm, and she wasn't going to let him get the best of her, so she went in the other room, got a shotgun, and shot him in the arm. They're in the pre-op unit of the emergency room, and they're separated by a deputy sheriff. They're both handcuffed to their stretchers. The husband looks over and says, "I love you, baby. I'm sorry I shot you." And she looks at him. She says, "I love you too, baby, and I'm sorry I shot you." Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say there wasn't a whole lot of joy in that marriage. But you do have the beginnings of a great country and western song. What keeps us from having a happy, joy-filled life? What keeps me, what keeps you from having joy in your life? Well, for one thing, we live in a very edgy age. You turn on the television and you see the news reports filled with worried, joyless, cranky people. We exist in a pressure cooker, and we feel it. There are financial stresses. There are continuing racial tensions. There are political pressures. The family is in crisis. Divorce is common. And the biblical definition of marriage is constantly being challenged in the political arena. And now people don't even know whether they're men or women anymore. How do you navigate it? How do you navigate through all this kind of stress? In a world like ours, optimism seems to just wear off real quickly. And then sadly, when you get right down to it, many of us who are Christians, many of us who belong to Jesus Christ, many of us who know that Jesus is preparing a home for us after this life is over, act as if there is no joy in our lives either. I remember reading a story about Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., and his career choice. If you remember, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. was a justice of the Supreme Court for 30 years. And he was known for his great mind, his keen wit, and his legal work. He earned the unofficial title as the greatest justice since John Marshall. And at one point in his life, Justice Holmes explained his choice of a career. He once said, "You know, rather than following the law, I might have entered the ministry if certain clergymen I knew had not looked and acted so much like undertakers." Now that, my friends, is a sad commentary on the ministry and its outlook on life. Perhaps it's like the little boy. Probably his name was Johnny. He was in church one Sunday morning with his mother. And he was a good little boy. He was very well behaved. He didn't cause any problems. But every once in a while, little Johnny would stand up in the pew. And when he stood up in the pew, he would turn around and look at the people behind him. And Johnny would smile at them. And that little boy and his smile was infectious. And pretty soon, as he would stand up in the pew and look back and smile at people behind him, they would begin to smile back at him. And everything was going splendidly until his mother realized what the little boy was doing. And when she realized what he was doing, she grabbed him by his ear and she twisted that ear and said, "Sit down and remember that you're in church." He started sniffling and crying. And she turned and said, "Now that's better, isn't it?" Isn't that sad? That some folks have the idea and they have the impression that when we come to church, it's all gloom and doom and there's not anything here to bring joy and happiness into our lives. Our attitude in the church, our attitude in our daily lives has an effect, beloved. It has an effect on how people perceive us as Christians and has an effect on how they perceive Christianity and how they perceive the church. Write this down. It's on the final exam. If all they see is a long, frowning face religion that does nothing, what is their opinion of Christianity going to be? Turn through the New Testament and see the Christ of the Gospels. See Jesus changing water to wine at a marriage feast in Cana of Galilee. See Him walking the dusty roads of Palestine, healing the sick, raising the dead, making the lame to walk, the blind to see, the deaf to hear. I don't see Jesus Christ. I do not see Jesus Christ as some long-faced, foot sliding, shoulder drooping, slow talking, depressed, sad individual? If he was, why would the crowds be attracted to a man like that? I see the Christ of the Gospels as an enthusiastic, dynamic man full of joy, happiness, and charisma. If the crowds were attracted to Jesus while he was here on this earth, that doesn't it make sense they would be attracted to Christians and to a church that lifted up, magnified, and personified Jesus today? Given a choice, all of us want to be around someone who's positive and someone who's upbeat and someone who's optimistic. Now, really and truly, if you had your choice of being around someone who had a smile or someone who looked like they had been weaned on a sour pickle, who are you going to most likely pick? I'm going to choose the smiley-faced person every time. Now, the point is, there's some difficult people that you deal with in this world. I've seen a lot of people. I've met a lot of people in the church, out of the church, and all over the world. I've met people that need an attitude transplant more than they need anything else. And one thing I have never been able to wrap my head around is the concept of a grumpy Christian. To me, the concept of a grumpy Christian is one of those oxymorons. One of those things like jumbo shrimp, military intelligence, an honest congressman, or one of my favorites, a plastic glass. How many times have all of us, would you bring me a glass of water? Did you want it in a glass or a plastic glass? How do you have plastic glass? It's either glass or it's plastic. You can't have a grumpy Christian either. You see, it's hard for me to understand how a man or a woman who claims to be walking with God can be grumpy for any length of time. So I want us to think about that this morning. I want us to think about living abundantly and restoring our joy. Because when you get right down to it, isn't restoring our joy and focusing on that something you and I would want to do as Christians? Becoming joyful to the point that it's infectious and that other people would want to have some of what we have? Well, think about it. What is joy? Joy is an evidence of God living in us. If God is in our lives, and if Jesus lives in our heart, then, beloved, the joy of the Lord is going to show in us. Now, let's not make the mistake of confusing happiness for joy, because that's an easy thing for us to do. Happiness depends on what happens to you. So if all the circumstances are right, then you can be happy. Joy comes from inside. When David wrote that beautiful, immortal 51st Psalm, David had lost his joy. You see, David had sinned. David is perhaps one of the most spectacular failures you'll find in the Bible. Remember the young boy David picking up 5 little stones in his sling? Remember him taking one of those stones and killing the Philistine giant Goliath? And we know he was a poet, composing more of the Psalms than anyone else? And yet, even though David was a man after God's own heart, David was human. And his failure started off so very simply. He was tired. And in that season of the year when the kings would go to war, he chose not to accompany his men in battle. And the roofs were flat, and David was walking one evening on the roof of the palace, and he saw a beautiful woman by the name of Bathsheba taking a bath. And as he saw her, he chose to let his eye linger just a bit too long. And then he thought. Then he acted. And one thing led to another in rapid succession. And before you knew it, David was sending one of his best soldiers to be killed. He had a man murdered to cover up a momentary indiscretion. It took God's man Nathan coming and breaking his heart, and that revealed his wickedness. To David's credit, David loved God. And David desired the joy of his salvation more than his sin. So he penned these words in Psalm 51. In verses 1 through 4 he writes, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee and thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightst be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest." And now look at verses 12 and 13. "Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and uphold me with thy free spirit. Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee." Why had David lost his joy? David had lost the joy of his salvation because he had lost his salvation. And he had lost his salvation because of his sin with Bathsheba. He prayed for his sins to be forgiven. And he prayed for the joy of his salvation to be restored. You see, when our lives become polluted by sin, we lose our joy in being Christians. It doesn't matter whether those sins are public or those sins are private. When we pollute our lives with sin, we lose the joy of our salvation. And yet, Luke chapter 8 gives us even another reason for the loss of our joy as Christians. In Luke chapter 8, you read the parable of the sower, and there Jesus talks about those who received the word with joy, but in verse 13, he speaks of those who had no root, so they withered away. There are folks sometimes that just don't have the stability of character to remain true to God. In that same parable, Jesus also talks about those whose salvation and the joy of their salvation is choked by the cares and the riches of life in verse 14 of Luke chapter 8. And that makes us think about the rich young ruler of Luke chapter 18. The young man that comes running to Jesus, he falls down at his feet, and Jesus says, and he says to Jesus, "Good master, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said, if you would enter into life, keep the commandments. He says, which? And Jesus enumerates them for him. He said, I've kept these from my youth up. What lack I yet? And Jesus, able to look into that young man's heart and able to ascertain what was the most important thing in the world to him, he said, if you want to be perfect, go and sell all that you have and give the money to the poor and come and follow me. Jesus was not preaching against the evils of being wealthy. Jesus was teaching the young man how important it was that rich or poor, great or small, nothing in this world could be more important than he was. It sickens me sometimes in our day and time to see politicians who one moment are taking the name of God in vain run to a microphone and try to pretend they are theologians and use Luke chapter 18 and the story of that rich young ruler and try to apply that passage literally to justify social reengineering in our country today. Jesus didn't say that that young man was sinful because he was wealthy and he had great possessions. Jesus said, son, nothing can be more important to you than I am. Because we read that the young man went away from Jesus sorrowfully because he had great possessions. Luke 8 and verse 14 tells about the parable of the sower and tells that some were choked, their joy of salvation was choked by the pleasures of this life. And that, of course, makes us think of Demas of 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10. Paul has written a letter from Rome in the prison cell to young Timothy in faraway Ephesus, and he's told him to come shortly to me and come before winter. And he says, he starts telling him about some of his other companions and friends that are in other places. And he mentions Demas, and he says, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. Demas is first mentioned for us in Philemon 24. And he's mentioned there as a fellow laborer with Paul. In Colossians 4 and verse 14, he's mentioned and his name is just on the church roll. And then Paul writes of his pathetic end, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. You see, what we see there is the downward spiral of Demas. From being so enthusiastic and so filled with the joy of his salvation, he's a co-laborer with Paul to the point that he's just on the roll, and then to the point that he's forsaken Paul because he loved the world. If you look to Moses, you see what it tells us in the Hebrew letter about Moses when he came to years. It says, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Oftentimes, and I've seen this more over and over and over in the 50 plus years since I preached my first sermon, over the years, oftentimes the fact that folks have been members of the church for some time, it makes us begin to feel secure. And then when we feel secure, we become indolent. And then with inactivity comes the slipping away of the joy that had come with the work of the Lord. Somewhere along the way, we lose sight of the importance of our salvation. And the cares of the world seem far more important to us than
the joy of salvation. We need to realize sometimes, we need to stop. Kind of like the old adage from the railroad, stop, look, and listen. We need to stop sometime. Take a long look and realize what the blood of Jesus Christ has saved us from. And we should also realize what we've been saved to do. That we've been saved to serve, not saved to be served. What did David say? David said, "Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation." David doesn't say that the rest of Israel needs the joy of their salvation. He didn't say they needed salvation. David realized that he himself, David, needed the joy of his salvation. Think of the things over the years we've heard church members say. "Well, you know, those folks at the church, they just don't give the way they ought to. You know, those folks at the church, they just don't have any enthusiasm like they ought to have. You know, those folks at church, they just don't do anything around there like they should. You know, those folks at the church, they don't," and you just fill in the blank, because people are going to always find something like that to fuss about. It may be quite true that there are members of the body of Christ that have lost the joy of their salvation. But to say that someone has lost the joy of their salvation is to dodge the issue. And it's an attempt to abdicate my own personal responsibility. Are you listening? Having the joy of our salvation and enthusiasm is an individual thing. We are each individually required to give an account of our talents. When you're burning with fire and breathing fire, you can set anything on fire. And I have yet to see a dead ember cause anything to burn. And what we have to do individually within our own hearts and mind is to reignite our fire of zeal for the Lord. What we need is a heavenly bonfire and a holy heartburn that would cause us to turn our city upside down for Jesus. When individuals are bustling with activity, when individuals are experiencing the joy of their salvation, when I'm experiencing the joy of my salvation, and you're experiencing the joy of your salvation, then you're going to see the church do great things. When we restore the joy of our own salvation, we're going to see the zeal for God's house eat us up. And we'll replace a defeatist attitude with the attitude of a victor. And we'll teach transgressors the way of the Lord as David prayed. And we'll be willing to spend and be spent in the service of Jesus. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9, Paul talks about the liberality of the Macedonians. And what does he say about them? They first gave themselves to the Lord. Now here's the question before the house this morning. Are you experiencing the joy of salvation today? To experience that joy, the first thing that needs to happen is there needs to be a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. In John chapter 15 and verses 5 and 6,
Jesus says, I am the vine and you're the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me you can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he's cast forth as a branch and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. When we become Christians, we're like a branch attached to Jesus Christ, the vine. He's the vine, we're the branches. There's a good song in the book about that. And as long as we're attached to Jesus Christ, the vine, we're going to bear fruit. That's where it begins, when we become a Christian. So, if you're not a Christian, that's the beginning place for this joy. Because you'll never have this joy until you're attached to Jesus, the vine. But if you're a Christian, and there's not a lot of joy in your life, there's not a lot of joy of your salvation, maybe you need to be reattached to the vine. One of my greatest concerns about the church all over the length and breadth of this nation of ours is there are detached branches dying, and sadly they don't realize it. They look alive. They sound like they're alive, but they're dead. Where are you this morning in your walk with the Lord? Do you feel the joy of your salvation? Do you need to be reattached to the vine? Do you need to come back to the Lord? And let brothers and sisters pray with you and for you. I don't know what's going on in your world. I don't know what the needs of your life are this morning. But if there are needs in your life we can help you meet, do not leave this building this morning without having in your heart the joy of your salvation. It's His invitation as we stand and while we sing.